I've been joined in the studio by local author Ruth Sutton. Good afternoon to you, Ruth.
Good afternoon, Paul.
Thanks for coming in. We've got your new book here called Cruel Tide, which is, I've been, you know, trying not to read the whole thing this month because I had work to do. You know, it's quite a hefty novel, 392 pages here. Without giving the plot away, obviously, Ruth, what's the plot?
Well, it's a classic crime story, I suppose. Mm. It's got a beginning and a middle and a kind of big climax at the end. It's about an issue which I was concerned about, having been in education for 30, 40 years, with the way we mistreated our children, especially in institutions in care, over the last half century or so, and it's an issue we face every day on the news.
I think we should say that although it is set in South Cumbria, this is purely fictional.
Absolutely fictional, yes. Yes. I had to do some research, obviously, on other cases in other parts of the UK where institutions had maltreated children, but there is absolutely no implication that anything like this happened in South Cumbria.
Mm. Now, I was saying, some people might think, oh, what a thing to write about.
I know, it's dark.
Yeah, it is dark, yes.
It is, and I'd struggled with that a little bit, but it's a classic story of wrongdoing and conspiracy and cover-up. And the fact that some people who are tenacious and well-meaning will really work away to try and discover what happened in cases like this.
Mm. And you set it back in 1969.
Then. 69, yeah.
Yeah. So, I remember 1969. You're just a young lass.
Me too.
Yeah, so, I mean, you had to sort of research back as to how people behaved back then. I mean, we're just talking about the people, as you mentioned, in care homes, but the police, journalists, and the general attitudes of people, I suppose.
Yes, quite different. Mm. Quite different. Well, you hope it's different anyway. Certainly, when you try to explain to people who don't remember 1969 what some things were like at that point, they find it really quite difficult to believe. What I've done in the book is try and look at various ways in which I think probably the main theme is how power can be abused. And it could be on a small scale, like with your boss, or on a larger scale, like the way we treat our children in society. But it's an interesting question. And because it's 50 years ago, I was able to pick away at it a little bit without, hopefully, causing any offence to people now. Although it's something I still think we need to think about.
Now, you've got the plot, you need the characters.
Yes.
So how do you come up with them?
Well, having written a trilogy previously and wanting to make some link, however tenuous, with all the previous work that I'd done, one of the characters almost presented herself, and she was the granddaughter of the heroine of the previous trilogy that I'd written. Judith Farrow we met her first in book two of the trilogy when she was six, and then book three she was 16, and she was a quite wayward teenager and at odds with her mother, and I thought, well, this sounds familiar. So I pushed her on another few years into 1969 and gave her a job and a bit of a dark past, and there she was. But I needed somebody else.
You need a foil, don't you?
I did.
Yeah.
So the foil was the young policeman who was a newcomer. He's come into Barrow from the Lancashire Force, and he's young and he's picky and plays it by the book, and everybody hates him. And he's got a funny name, so they do what they normally
do. It's of Italian extraction.
It is of Italian extraction, yes. And Tognerizer's, of course, was a coffee bar in Ulverston when I was growing up there, so that name presented itself. But Sam and Judith, she's very random and very scatty, and he's very meticulous. And they don't like each other. About the same age, they don't like each other, and it made for a nice tension between them.
That's a recipe, though, for them falling in love, isn't it, basically?
Oh, well, yes. Know? Somebody asked me yesterday, will they? and I've left it deliberately ambivalent, I'm afraid.
It's like the old black and white television. You just knew that, you know, the girl that came in it and Stuart Granger didn't want anything to do with it. You just knew he was going to marry her at the end.
Well, they certainly haven't got together by the end of book one. I hope I'm not giving too much away there. But we've got a few more books to come, I think, after this.
But, yeah, the Detective Constable Sam Tognarelli.
Yeah.
With a name like that, it could be in Cagney and Lacey, couldn't you, if you think about it? You've got to give him a past as well, haven't you?
So yes.
How do you come up with that? Because there is quite a twist in there, isn't there, about his past?
Yeah, I don't know. How do you think about these things? You just kind of let your imagination run riot, really. Mm. And you think about people you've known with that kind of disposition and the way he looks and the way he walks and his accent and what might have made him as meticulous and as risk-averse that he is as he is now. And it doesn't take much. You don't have to come up with much to put a few things together. Not whole people that you remember, but bits of things that you remember. And I distinctly remember somebody telling me about a young woman who left her husband and didn't just leave. She took a furniture van and removed every item of furniture.
Including the light bulbs, yes.
From the house. And he came home one day from work and discovered that the house was just an empty shell. Mm. And that image stuck with me. And that's in there. I can't even remember who told me that about who, but years and years ago, that image has remained with me. What would that do to somebody?
Mm.
And that's something that just kind of triggers a kind of caution in a person after that, that they were very hard to trust anybody after that happened.
Did he then, did you have him fully formed, if you like, along with Judith, before the book started, or did they both characters evolve?
What I tend to do is get so far into it and then decide to myself, I've got to write this down. And I write what's called a character study.
Mm.
I just start again writing on a different piece of paper or a different document, and I start with, you know, Sam Tognarelli, born such and such, parents here, there. Much of that will never appear in the book. But it's almost as if I have to flesh out this person before I can actually understand how they're going to, what they're going to say and how they're going to say it.
And how they're going to react in certain situations.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Situations that you're going to put them in.
Yes.
So how much research did you have to do for that? How long did it take?
The research and the planning take longer than the writing.
Mm.
The research for this one wasn't quite as meticulous as it had been for the previous ones because of the nature of the plot, the action. I had to distance myself from the locations a wee bit because you don't want things to be too identifiable. Barrow is, Ulverston is, but the places in between, Morecambe Bay, Morecambe, bits of Lancaster, but you don't want to set the baddies in a particular clearly identifiable community because that community might understandably be upset.
Mm.
So all the meticulous place research I'd done before didn't really happen, but the issues needed to be researched and policing in the 1960s needed to be researched.
And I suppose the geography too, because you know how long it takes to get from Barrow to Morecambe. The fact that you can see it across the water.
I live close, right? And Cumbria is my home county, so a lot of that kind of basic understanding of how the county is situated, that was easy.
Mm. Now, there's other characters, obviously, apart from these two that come in, you know, the police, the editor of the newspaper, and the people that get interviewed and the suspects. How do you keep all those plates going, all those different characters?
You need to keep some notes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not as good at this as I should be. You need really a file card system of who the editor is and who his wife is and who the police constable is and the sergeant and the inspector and the chief inspector. And sometimes you get a bit of a muddle about things and you have to go back and sort it out. But generally speaking, with the main characters particularly, you keep notes and you don't lose track.
Mm. Did the book then continue on the path that you set it off, or did you find yourself being taken up little avenues and it taking on a life of itself, if you like?
Well, that's where the planning comes in. The first book I wrote took 4 years because I didn't plan it.
Right.
And it went off all over the place and then had to be reined in. But so I learned from that experience that you can't really start writing until you've planned not 100% of it, but 90% of it is already clear when you start to write. Now, it still goes off.
Do you find that a little frustrating, though, Ruth? Because you want to get on with this story, but you've got to rein yourself back.
I do. Mm. I've learned that it's more effective to do it. Because if you don't plan, if I don't plan, the thing gets away from me and is a nightmare with cutting and pasting and filling in backstories and getting details wrong and forgetting what the sister's name was and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So the planning is you just have to get your head down and do it. Because when you do that, the writing is just straight. It's just a wonderfully fluid experience when you start to write. You can lose yourself in it for hours at a time. I love that.
So as you're going through it, obviously starting at chapter one and going through it, do they say to get halfway through, have to go back and just reread stuff just to see
I reread as I go. Every chapter I write, you go back and you go back and you read it over and read it over until you move on.
Mm.
So, and every now and then you go back and take a longer look at what you're doing and where it's going. But generally speaking, you've done that at the planning stage.
Right. And then it takes on, and then at the end of it, you probably have to, with a critical eye, sort of edit it, do you?
Oh, I don't edit. I get somebody else.
Right.
I have a story editor and a kind of proofreader, and she and I work very closely together. So what appears in the book finally will be the, I don't know, sixth, seventh, eighth version, often, of what's been written, with bits taken out and conversations changed and characters moved from A to B. And, you know, there's a lot of moving around goes on before you get to the final draft.
But this is your baby.
Yes.
This is your story. Yes. These are your characters.
Yes.
How good are you at allowing somebody else to come in and do that?
I wrote a blog piece about that the other day, actually, about what is the role of the editor. Mm. And at the end of the day, yes, it is my story. And she will say that from time to time. This is your story, Ruth, your final call on what you want to do. Mm. But it's actually quite useful to have another pair of eyes on it every now and then.
Because you get too close to it.
You do get too close. You can't see the wood for the trees sometimes. Mm. And it's very helpful to have somebody there saying, are you sure about this? Or the continuity is wrong here. Or it would have been Wednesday, not Tuesday. And those kind of chronology things that you can get mixed up with if you're not careful.
Mm. And do you need that person to say, that's it, finish, leave it alone?
Probably. We get to the stage after the nth version of it that you're saying to yourself, that's enough now. Mm. I mean, reading it again now, I keep thinking, oh, I should have changed this. And it's not so much the story that needs to change now. It's the structure of a paragraph or the phrase that somebody uses or even the punctuation. You're thinking, could be better. It could always be better. But at some point, you just got to stop.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the discipline, isn't it? To know when it's finished. But again, I come back to the fact, you know, you've got this great idea inside you, you want to get it out there. There must be great discipline, Ruth, to stop yourself just saying, I'm going to publish what I've just written without it being reined back in.
Oh, yeah,
and without rewriting it three or four times.
You've got to have people, you can't just publish it, people got to read it.
Mm.
And if once it's out, it's yours. And if you've got any sense of self-respect, you don't want anything out there with your name on it that's not as good as you can actually make it.
Mm.
It's embarrassing, frankly. If I'd read through that now as it is, printed up, and found a spelling mistake or a gross grammar mistake, I would have been absolutely mortified.
Yeah.
I may still find it, and I will be mortified. But because it's there, and you can't change it once it's printed, and it's in the shop, you can't just put a sticker on it saying, look, I made a mistake on page 237. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. You've got to live with it.
Yeah.
And you've got to feel proud of what you've done. Mm.
So you're quite happy then now to sit down and actually read your own books?
Well, I'm reading...
Can you read them objectively then?
It's hard because I know where it all came from. I can't read it as a reader would who's coming to it fresh.
Mm.
And that's the frustration, because you can't ever experience that. But I'm presenting like I'm doing in Cockermouth tonight at the bookshop in Cockermouth. At 5, I'll have people there and I'll be talking about the book and the characters and the events. And I'll be reading bits of it. I always do.
Mm.
Not plot spoiler bits, but some bits. So you're constantly revisiting and looking again at what you've written. And I have to feel good about what I've written, or it's a daily embarrassment.
Mm, I was just going to say, you start off with your rough notes and the plot line,
mm-hmm.
and then you end up with the finished book, and mm-hmm. when you compare the two, are they still in sync?
Pretty well, mm. yes, they are, because the planning was pretty detailed. And it ends up... The end of anything is never absolutely a given. You know, you come to a decision about how it might end. I wrote that last chapter or two 4 or 5 times,
mm-hmm.
Ending it in different ways. And I've done that before with books. You never quite know what you can get away with. I didn't want to tie it up with a red ribbon, because life is more complicated than that. I didn't want all the goodies to win and all the baddies to be sent to jail, because life is more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to... You know, and reader, I married him kind of stuff, you know. I wanted to leave the Sam-Judith relationship a little bit ambivalent,
mm-hmm.
because it was, and it should be, and I wanted readers to come back and have another go at it.
Mm.
So I'm kind of setting myself up for book 2 of this series. So I wasn't quite sure how that would all end when I started, and I'm reasonably happy with it now, but... You know, I could still have done it differently.
How long in total then has it taken you from the time coming up with the original idea to it appearing on the, you know, that sits off to the publishers now?
This one took a little over a year, a little longer than the previous one, because I took a big break in the middle, this year, mm. when I went overseas. So I had to kind of suspend the whole thing for a while. But normally speaking, you'd have... I'm working on the second of this series now in my head. What is it now, November? And I'm aiming to publish again in November next year.
Right.
So that's a year.
Well, you say you took a break, but I would imagine, even when you're taking a break, the storyline's going round in your head.
Well, it depends where you are and what you're doing. I was in Antarctica.
Oh, right.
It was pretty mind-consuming.
Mm.
You know, you don't have much space in your head when you're surviving out there to have plot lines rolling about.
Yeah.
So I just decided I would put it to one side, literally and completely, yeah. because I really couldn't do anything else, as far as I was able to.
Right. Well, I mean, before you went up to Antarctica, then, I mean, does a thing like this take over your life? I mean, are you constantly...
I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
And when I start dreaming it, you know, yeah. it's time to get writing.
Yes.
Because yeah. you do dream it.
What were we doing in Antarctica, just as
We were on a... we went to Patagonia for a couple of weeks walking, and then
nice.
A three-week cruise round the Antarctic Peninsula in the Falklands in South Georgia.
Sounds nice.
I know, trip of a lifetime.
Yeah. Was the weather half decent around Cape Horn then?
Oh, it was rough. Very rough. And the ship had no stabilisers, so that's another story.
Rather you than me. Rather you than me, Ruth. So this is, it's a rivet and read. I tried not to get involved in it upstairs, but I'm afraid I failed miserably. It all starts with, you know, the body of a young child being found in the sands at Morecambe Bay, and away yeah. you go from there, isn't it?
It's, yeah.
I think it will, you know, touch a lot of people. But as you say, it is purely fiction,
yeah,
and we shouldn't read anything into it. The fact that it happens to be set in this area is because you know the area. Basically.
Yes, it is, and that was a problem for me. But I hope that we've managed to combine fact and fiction, understanding that the facts of the case came from somewhere else completely, mm. which they did.
And a Vespa scooter is involved.
Indeed. A red Vespa
scooter. A red Vespa scooter. Yes. Wonderful. Ruth, lovely to talk to you.
And you, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in. Thanks.
Bye-bye.